This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss collagen supplementation with nutraceutical formulator Dr. Gordon Chang. We'll discover a mindful perspective on time with mindfulness expert and author Alex Snyder. We'll find out about high-vibe relationships with authors Deborah Stangl and Richard Keppel. And lastly, we'll learn about global gut microbiome with health and wellness researcher David Nelson. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. A new study funded by the National Institutes of Health has found that some oral weight loss and diabetes medication may reduce eating for pleasure by changing activity in the brain. Researchers studied two drugs, orfoglipron and danuglipron, in mice and discovered that they affected the brain area linked to reward and cravings. Scientists already knew that GLP-1 drugs, such as semaglutide, help reduce hunger by affecting parts of the brain that control appetite. However, this study found that newer oral versions also activate the central amygdala, a region involved in pleasure and reward. This reduced the release of dopamine, a chemical that makes enjoyable activities such as eating tasty foods feel rewarding. The findings suggest that these medications may do more than help people eat less because they're full. They may also reduce cravings for unhealthy foods by making them less appealing. Researchers hope to study whether these drugs could also help treat substance use disorders by reducing cravings for addictive substances. I'll be joined by Dr. Gordon Chang in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Omega Alpha's products are created by their scientific team, headed by their owner, operator, and CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Dr. Chang holds a PhD in physiology and biomedical engineering from the University of Toronto. He also has 2 years postdoctoral experience in clinical biochemistry, looking at free radicals and antioxidants. He's published over 20 peer-reviewed articles and conference proceedings, and he's a frequent guest on the show. Welcome back, Gordon. How are you?
Very good, Jimmy. Thanks for having me back on again.
So lots of people are taking collagen, and there's lots of people online talking about taking collagen, but I'm wondering if the hype is warranted and, you know, whether we should be taking collagen and, you know, the best way of doing it. So can you help us out with that today?
We'll try. One of the things I've heard with collagen is everybody talks about the different types of collagen, type 1, type 2, type 3, etc. There's a whole different bunch of collagens, right? But structurally, I mean, every single collagen known to man is made up of amino acids. And if we take the amino acids that you find in type 1, type 2, type 3, etc., basically it's all the same amino acids in there. Okay, so there's really no difference between type 1, type 2, type 3, type 4, whatever collagens. Structurally, they're made up of the same amino acids. Now, there might be differences between a collagen that comes from a cow, bovine collagen, versus something that comes from the sea, which is like a marine collagen, a fish collagen. These collagens usually come from the bones, or come, in the case of fish, it comes from the skin, right? That's where they extract it from. Now, collagen starts off at life, its life in the body. There are different forms of it that you'll find in the body. The nice thing about collagen, as I said, it's used in structural components, so it makes your skin more elastic, right? It is used in blood vessels. It is found in things like joints, your cartilage. All those things have collagen in it. And the things like joints and so on, the structural components. They are found in, if you want to make fresh cartilage or new cartilage, you got to have collagen in there as one of the ingredients. Now, after having said all that, collagen, when you take collagen as a liquid or as a powder or what have you, the body doesn't absorb collagen as collagen, right? Collagen is a complex protein. When it's absorbed in the body, it has to be broken down into its component amino acids. And when these amino acids get absorbed, the body sees an influx of a whole bunch of these amino acids, which is very special to collagen. So you have like proline, hydroxyproline. Those are two of the top ones, right? And collagen is one of the biggest sources of those components. So when the body sees all that, the body says, hey, we have a lot of these components coming in. You know what? Let's make some extra collagen, right? That is why it when you intake collagen, it makes more collagen in your body. Your body has to take these amino acids and then make them into more collagen. A precursor of collagen, before you even get to collagen, is gelatin, right? So your jello is a precursor of collagen. Now, your body, if we were to take gelatin, how do you make collagen? You take gelatin, you break it down with enzymes, you break it down with amino acids, and you get something called collagen. And sometimes collagen is also known as collagen peptides. And basically what that is that the collagen peptides are chopped up gelatin into smaller pieces. And because it's chopped up into smaller pieces, it dissolves a lot easier. So if you're taking gelatin will have a lot of the same components as collagen itself. Right now, there's a huge hype on collagen. I know that. My theory on a lot of these things, again, it's a good ingredient to consume, but it is not the only thing you have to consume it with. Because when you take collagen, you want to make some fresh collagen for the skin. Well, you got to have B vitamins for that to happen. You got to also have vitamin C for that to happen. And sometimes if you take it in conjunction with things like hyaluronic acid, right, it makes your collagen work even better.
When we talk about the food sources for collagen, so you were talking about like gelatin and gelatin products. Are there certain, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, Gordon, but like if you have like a piece of meat that has a lot of connective tissue, something like a short rib, is that the collagen as well?
That's a source of collagen. Any connective tissue is a source of collagen. Now, in all fairness to us, is that for us to eat connective tissue, you got to cook that sucker for a long time before it gets soft enough that you can actually chew the bloody thing, right?
Yep.
So as a way of getting collagen into your system, it's a lot easier to get it as a collagen drink.
Okay.
Right? The collagen drink is a nice way of getting it because it's pre-dissolved. Your body just have to absorb it. And it's pre-dissolved, it digests a lot faster. It digests a lot easier.
Got it. As we get older, can our bodies metabolize collagen and can we produce it as well as when we're younger?
One of the things with collagen, as we get older, it's a matter of digestion,
mm-hmm.
all right? If I give you a chunk of meat, it's tougher to digest a chunk of meat than if I were to give you the collagen peptides, okay? Because you have to remember, the chunk of meat, you have to break down a lot more protein to get to the amino acids. Whereas if I give you collagen peptides, you don't have to work as, your digestive system does not have to work as hard to get the amino acids out of it. right? So you get a much richer amount of the amino acids, like the proline and the hydroxyproline. Those are the mainstays of collagen.
Do we necessarily have to take collagen orally? Like, is there such a thing as topical collagen?
Topical collagen, your body will not absorb much through the skin.
Okay.
Okay. So if you do absorb, you know, it's a lot, you can get a lot better off by just consuming it. Right.
Okay.
Absorption through the skin is very minimal. It's not even worth it. If you're looking at that as a source of your collagen, you're going to have a big problem. You're not going to get enough.
Okay.
So the reason we consume the collagen is because as we get older, our biochemistry and enzymes that we have to make fresh skin, etc., diminishes, right? And so what we're hoping to do is that if you increase the collagen, you're priming those enzymatic systems to make new collagen. And that's what you're trying to do with a larger intake of collagen.
Got it. At what age should one consider start supplementing with collagen, do you think?
There is no magic age. I mean, it's like, you know, it doesn't hurt to start early with supplementation. But if I'm young, let's say I'm in my 20s, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In your 20s, no matter what you do, you're looking good.
Yep.
Right? In all fairness. So, you know, and people in their younger years eat a lot more things, have a broad spectrum of different foods, right? As we get older, we don't eat as much. And then to top it off, also our ability to manufacture fresh tissue, etc., also starts to deteriorate, right? So maybe I would say probably about 35 people start, but there's no magic cutoff because, you know, some people age differently than others. So some people will look at the skin in the early 30s or late 20s and say, hey, my skin looks like it's saggy, especially if you've been out in the sun, etc., etc., etc. You know, it doesn't hurt to take more collagen. And the thing is, it's a food. And because it's a food, right, it's like asking me, how much protein should I take? Right? Is there a magic cutoff on the amount of protein I consume? Usually when we talk about food, is basically how much you can get into you and what satisfies you, right?
Mm-hmm. So is there an amount of collagen that we should be taking if we're supplementing?
There's no magic amount. It's basically, I would probably say 5 to 10 grams a day, right? But none of this is carved in stone anywhere,
mm-hmm.
right? Again, because it's a supplement. I mean, people ask me the same question sometimes when we're dealing with fish oil, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, somebody might say to you, oh, you just need one gram a day, right? But, you know, if I was living in Norway where I eat a lot of fish, they consume a hell of a lot more than 1 gram a day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Without any ill effects. So basically what I'm trying to say is that whatever we say, it's not detrimental to take a lot more than whatever I talk about.
Fair enough. You mentioned vitamin C as sort of being crucial to help metabolize and have the body use the collagen effectively. Does that mean we should be supplementing with vitamin C if we're taking collagen?
Not only vitamin C. Remember when last time I spoke about the different ingredients, it's all complexes.
Yeah.
Right. In order to make collagen, B vitamin, if just to drive the biochemistry for it to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you do in collagen, with collagen also, is make extracellular matrix, which goes to make cartilage, which is and also used to make bone. Right?
Yes.
So for that to happen also, you need to have trace minerals. So you need your things like your zinc, your copper, your manganese. So it's all of those things together, right? Mm-hmm. To optimize, right? But you've got to start somewhere. So collagen is a good starting point. So minimum also, I would also take with that some trace minerals, right? And by trace minerals, I'm talking about your zinc, your copper, your manganese, not your calcium system. I mean, you do need calcium, right? So those are your macro minerals, but you also need your micro minerals. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things you've got to consume together to give you to maximize your benefits. That's basically what I'm saying.
Off the top, you mentioned there are different types of collagen. Is there one that is the most bioavailable, or are they all pretty much the same in terms of being able to be absorbed?
When the collagen that you consume in your collagen powders, your collagen liquids, right?
Mm-hmm.
All what those are, they're basically regular collagen, type 1, type 2, type 3, whatever is source of your collagen. It's already chopped up into smaller peptides, right? So because it's already chopped up, right, and your body doesn't absorb collagen as collagen 1, or type 1 collagen, type 2 collagen, type 3 collagen. It absorbs it as the amino acids,
right,
the structural things that make up collagen. Right. And in all fairness, the difference between type 1, type 2 and type 3 is basically how that naming system came up, because when people looked at it, the types of collagen grew in different ways. One is fibrous and it forms like a string. The other ones are in flat sheets. Right. But if you take those same collagens and you break it down to the amino acids, it's practically the same, right? And since your body doesn't absorb collagen as type 1 or type 2, it's irrelevant how the collagen comes from, how it comes, right? It is basically broken down by your body to get absorbed as the amino acids.
I asked earlier whether collagen should be taken with other supplements, but if you're taking collagen, are there supplements you shouldn't take with collagen?
Not that I know of, not that is out there in the medical literature or the scientific literature.
Okay, so what you're saying is it's safe, and if we take a little bit more, there's not going to be too much of a problem for our health.
Not a problem at all.
Time for one last question, and that is, should men and women be taking collagen differently? Are the needs different? Is there anything that a male or a female should consider as different if they're thinking about supplementing?
I don't think there's any differences in the quantity that you should be taking. So there's nothing that says that. You have to remember, you've got to treat collagen like a food as opposed to like a vitamin.
Got it.
Okay.
Yep.
The nice thing about foods in your body, if you take a lot of collagen, and let's say your body doesn't need it to make any more, because you can only make so many more different types of collagen in your body from the raw material. Those same amino acids can be used for different things in the body. So basically, you're giving the body a lot more ingredients to make things.
That makes sense. And in terms of it being beneficial, is it beneficial for both men and women in the same way?
Oh, definitely beneficial for both men and women. Because again, if the thing is, you know the old saying, you are what you eat.
Yep.
People don't realize how true that is. If I take a lot of collagen, right, and if my skin is saggy a little bit, well, all of a sudden the body comes in and there's tons of these amino acids that can be used to make collagen to tighten up your skin, right? So it will do that. But it's like anything else. You're never going to have skin like when you were 5 years old, 10 years old, 15 year old, right?
Yeah.
When you're pushing 60, I don't care how much collagen you consume, you're never going to have the same type of skin as a five-year-old kid.
Well, that makes sense. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Jamie, for having me.
That was Dr. Gordon Chang. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild-crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety, including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
People just like you, with pain, inflammation, and mobility loss, are traveling to BioFlex Laser Therapy Clinic for treatment.
The clinic is helping Canadians and patients from around the world move better, feel stronger, and live without limitations, all thanks to BioFlex Advanced Laser Therapy. If your goal is to reduce inflammation, relieve pain, and support recovery without medication, injections, or downtime, get to know BioFlexClinic.com. Trusted, non-invasive care.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Alex Snyder is a writer, facilitator, and former government strategist who bridges the worlds of mission-driven leadership and mindfulness. After spending more than 15 years inside high-pressure federal environments, along with a life-altering bike accident that reshaped his perspective on urgency and attention, he began questioning whether constant speed, pressure, and responsiveness were actually helping people live, lead, and relate more meaningfully. A meditation teacher and co-founder of Mindful Fed, Alex explores what modern busyness gives us and what it quietly takes away in his book, Sometimes You Should Be Late. He holds degrees from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Georgetown's University School of Foreign Service. To learn more about Alex and his work, you can visit slowmindfulness.com. Welcome back, Alex. How are you?
Thanks, Jamie. It's good to be here. I'm doing well.
So last time you were on the show, we discussed why lunatics like me get so upset with delays and lineups and traffic jams, etc. But the work that you do isn't just about teaching people why they shouldn't be stressed out in those moments. There's a little bit more to it, right?
Yeah. So Jamie, the thing is, no one is crazy for being stressed out about time. No one is crazy for being in a line and wanting the line to not be there, or to wanting your work colleague or the person you're waiting for at the coffee shop to be there. We're not crazy. We have full lives and we want to get on with it. That makes sense. The problem is when we lose the flexibility to remember what actually matters in a moment. If your friend who maybe is with their toddler at home and is kind of struggling to get out the door shows up 5 minutes late for coffee, there's something beyond just those 5 minutes. And what I want my book and my work at Slow Mindfulness to help people remember is that we have choice about how we move through time. We can be a little bit self-righteous and say, well, I got here at time and you didn't. Or we can be compassionate to our friend with the toddler. We can take a few breaths ourselves and maybe remember that we wanted to send an email anyway. And so my invitation isn't to say that hustling or be stressed out about time or deadlines is a bad thing. It's just not the only thing. How does that resonate with you, Jamie?
Yeah, I understand your perspective. So in the process of thinking about this, what have you learned about the assumptions that people make when they feel like somebody is moving too slowly or too quickly for us?
So one of the things I've learned, and I sort of knew this instinctually before I started writing the book, is the neuroscience behind this, about how in our modern world, time and urgency and pressure and efficiency are such important things that they trigger the same fear centers as, you know, tigers or actual dangers back for our caveman ancestors. And so one of the things I really become attuned to is this idea that when there is a threat around time, that we are a bit in this reactive place. And that is part of why when someone is late, when a colleague doesn't get back to us, why it hits so hard is because our attention is narrowed. We're focusing exclusively on that one thing, getting there on time, getting the project done. It makes sense for us to be so frustrated because our attention is narrowed. It's sort of, in the book, I use the metaphor of a horse with blinders. You know, those horses are focused on the track ahead or on the path they need to do, and we're blocking out other things. And that has a purpose, but we also miss out the larger perspective. And our brains are doing that sort of very naturally. Just like when there's a tiger stalking you in the savannah, you're not worried about where your next meal is. You're not worried about talking to someone else. You're worried about getting away from that tiger. Similarly, when we're feeling behind in our life, we're focused primarily on that time pressure, and we're not thinking about other things like what our choices are or what someone else might be going through in their life.
Is it relevant to consider how our, I'll call it an internal clock, impacts others?
Absolutely. I sort of pause because time is inherently relational.
Right.
I don't know if you know the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks when he's on this island by himself with a volleyball named Wilson. Mm-hmm. For him, time really didn't matter. There wasn't anyone to coordinate with. There wasn't anyone to plan around. He basically went about his day as he wanted to. But in our life, whether it's an interview for a radio show like this or meeting up for a hike or anything in between, we have to coordinate with others, and which means we're going to be subject to different stories, different fears, different wounds around time. And so when we talk about considering other people's clocks, we have to think about those clocks for two different reasons. One, just practically, when we're trying to coordinate, like what does it mean for us to be 5 minutes, 10 minutes late? Is that important? Can we talk about that? But there's also the stories that we tell about it. For example, in my book, I talk about a colleague I had at the White House who was super punctual, super prepared, had these like color-coded notes of her to-dos, and she was very much trying to organize her life in a very coherent, crisp way. For me to show up late for a meeting and say, come on, just chill, was not a way for me to be relational, to be attuned to her. That said, for me to absorb some of the urgency, some of the pressure that she felt pretty often, that also wasn't the way I wanted to live my life. And so what I learned about working with her is there are things that I can do to honor the care that she had, the diligence that she had about timelines, about punctuality, but also as circumstances changed, as things came up in my life, to not feel like I was wrong or bad if I was doing it differently than her.
I get that. I guess there's, you know, I can't imagine a higher pressure situation than working in the White House. And I've had different types of jobs and different stops in my career where time actually was incredibly important. For example, when you're a lawyer and you have to file materials and there's a deadline, and you can't really be blasé about the deadline. You either meet the deadline or you don't. And if you don't, there's ramifications. And I think, you know, for people who don't want to be organized, who are less responsive to time constraints, they probably shouldn't be in those types of jobs because they're not suited for it. I don't know. That's what I would say. Could you function in the White House if you were missing deadlines?
I think what I'm kind of feeling like hearing you, Jamie, is sort of the sense that there's some jobs and some careers where maybe deadlines and timing is a bit more important.
Sure.
And maybe some areas where it's less important.
Correct.
But the thing that feels really important to me, this goes back to what I was saying earlier about flexibility. Mm-hmm. So in a place like the White House, I basically supported them for 2.5 years working on something called the President's Management Agenda. Mm-hmm. On one hand, there are deadlines. There are things that feel pretty rigid.
Yep.
There's also some deadlines that are a little bit, they're useful fictions. Like we want to get this project launched, and so we're going to aim for this date. For me, to be a leader, the key skill that you need is discernment. And it's the discernment to say, when does this deadline, when does this project really, really matter to get done today? And to tell your team, I know it's 5 p.m., but this is important. Let's stay late to do this because it matters for X, Y, or Z reason. And there's that moment when you're the leader, when you're looking at your team and you see the bags under their eyes and you see this, the body language that they're exhausted, and you tell them, you know what, this can wait till tomorrow. Please go home, be with your families. What I'm really urging in this book is awareness of the costs of constantly meeting the deadlines. I have a chapter called The High Cost of Being on Time, mm-hmm. because we focus so much on if we miss the deadline, we're going to miss our chance to get this proposal in. And that's possible. And those do have consequences. I'm not going to deny that. But the problem is, what is the cost of burning out the best people on your team and they quit the next week? And then you have to go on a 6-month hiring process to find the replacements, for example. That is what I want people to be more attuned to and to make a conscious choice about when to go fast, when to hit the deadline, and when to slow down and ask the question about, can we push this deadline? Can we skip this project? Those kinds of questions.
So when we talk about time being relational, and you raise the distinction between what we do in our normal lives or perhaps when we're on vacation, why is it that somebody who's fixated on deadlines can sort of switch gears and not care about time when they're on vacation? And how do we reconcile that and bring a little bit of that vacation mindset into our regular lives?
So on my book, it's called Sometimes You Should Be Late. and there's a sloth on the cover. And it's a little bit of a false advertising, I might say, because it's not a book about slowing down for its own sake. It's not a book that says, you know what, just chill, like this world's too busy, just slow down. What I'm arguing is something a little bit different. I'm saying that when we slow down, we start to have choice about the right pace. And so what you're describing of moving from maybe a busy work world as a lawyer, as a financial investor, and then going to vacation, what often is missing is the slowing down to recognize whether the same patterns that are playing out in your workplace are present in your vacation time. And so when we slow down and actually notice, oh my God, I'm agitated that the family's not ready to go. We said we'd be out the door at 10. I'm noticing there's some stress here. Is that something I want to respond to in this moment? Or is that a moment to say, oh, interesting, I'm feeling like I'm still in my workplace, yet I'm on vacation. What is the right choice right now? And one of the examples I wanted to give out to you is I talk about the difference between frantic rushing and joyful rushing in the book. It's okay to rush on a workplace, and it's okay to rush on vacation. You know, you want to hit those four sites before your plane takes off. It's cool to do that. The key is to make that a conscious choice to say, you know what, we're only going to see the Parthenon or whatever we are for a little bit of time and then go to the next site because we want to see it all, to be able to check those boxes of things that different family members wanted to see. And there's a difference between the frantic rushing, which is, oh my God, we're not going to do this, what an awful thing, and the joyful rushing, which is like, hey, family, we're in this together. We're going to try to hit all these things. And if we don't, like, it's not the end of the world. We tried. And I think that for me requires some slowness. To recognize when you're feeling triggered, when you're feeling like we're not doing enough, when the same patterns transfer to vacation. When we slow down, we can recognize that they're there and make a different choice.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It's great to be with you, Jamie. Thank you.
That was Alex Snyder. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss high vibe relationships. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian-owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000-square-foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Feeling tired, low on energy, or simply not getting enough vitamin B12? Discover the difference with Purely Organic Active B12. Made with premium active methylcobalamin, the natural form your body absorbs and uses instantly. Unlike common synthetic B12 supplements, Purely Organic Active B12 contains no colors, flavors, sweeteners, or preservatives. Just clean, organic, vegan support for energy, endurance, and nervous system health. Purely Organic Active B12. Pure energy, naturally made in Canada.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
What if the real problem in most relationships isn't communication, but the unresolved emotional pain underneath the conflict? Deborah Stangl and her husband and co-author Richard Keppel explore this question in their forthcoming book, High Vibe Relationship: Why Love Isn't the Problem and What Actually Is, and that's due out in September. After spending 20 years as a divorce attorney, Deborah realized that most people don't really want divorce. They want the fighting and emotional pain to stop. Richard built a successful career in Silicon Valley before a life-altering stroke produced a profound personal transformation. He brings a unique blend of neuroscience, spirituality, and emotional insight to their transformational relationship work. Together, through the Sedona Soul Adventures, they help individuals and couples uncover the hidden emotional patterns, unresolved wounds, nervous system triggers, what they call gunk, and which quietly sabotages intimacy, emotional safety, and connection. And for more information, you can visit highviberelationship.com. Welcome to the show, both of you. How are you?
Really great.
Thanks for the opportunity.
So high vibe relationships, I'm very intrigued by that, and hopefully we'll figure out what that is in due course. But off the top, you say that love isn't the problem between fighting partners, but rather it's unhealed pain. What do you mean by that?
So everyone has what we call gunk, old wounds and patterns and trauma from long before the time that you met your partner. And so what happens between people is that what looks like a fight about money or sex or loading the dishwasher is really never the real issue. It's the old wound getting triggered. And that's why couples keep having the same fight over and over again and why they go into disconnection.
You think that most couples don't understand what they're actually fighting about. But what is what is it that they are actually fighting about?
Well, what they're fighting about is really their old wounds from childhood. Like, for example, a core wound could be something like, I'm not lovable, or I don't matter, or I cannot be loved. And so every time something gets triggered, they're back to their childhood state. They're no longer an adult. And so they behave as if they're a wounded child. And that takes over then the experience between the two.
And people assume that it's the other person causing trouble, giving them a hard time. But that's not what it is. It's the other person triggering this wound, which is coming up for healing. And when you heal that and you have those triggers then fall away, that's when connection just naturally follows again.
Okay, so I've been married. I've been with the same person since I was 20. So it's been 40 years. I can tell you that sometimes when you're fighting about money, you're really fighting about money. I mean, not every fight is about a childhood wound, though, is it?
Absolutely, it is. I know it feels like you're really talking about money, but you're not. It is that young child who is afraid. And I know this. Money was a big, giant wound for me because of what happened with everything with my family. It is always these younger versions of ourselves that are coming out, the fear, the trauma. That's what's being activated. And when you heal that, that's when those triggers don't have the same kind of charge.
So you practice as a divorce attorney for a number of years. Regular listeners know that I was actually a commercial litigator for 20 years before I got this gig. So you're seeing people at their worst, right? When they're litigating. Not the time to be having these kind of, how shall I call it, deeper conversations about, you know, what's really driving the discord. But do you honestly feel like those divorces could have been avoided if the couples had approached their problems differently?
Yes, if I had done with my clients then what I do with my clients now, it would have been a completely different situation. I was a divorce attorney for 20 years. And one of the rules was all of my clients had to go to therapy. And in that 20 years, I didn't have one marriage that was saved. But that's because I didn't really understand what was going on underneath. And clients come to us now at Sedona Soul Avengers where they've already filed for divorce. And we are able to turn it around because they're seeing that the arguments, the recurring arguments that they're having and the disconnection that they're having is not from a problem with this other person. It is what is going on underneath the surface.
In your experience, are both parties typically experiencing these sort of traumas that they're reliving, or is it more likely that it's one of the two that is?
In actuality, everybody has core wounds and gunk. Everybody does. And they're probably different for each couple. And that's what makes it really interesting because you're not being triggered by the same things. So yeah, everybody's got them. And if everybody can figure out you have them and begin to heal them, then as Deborah said earlier, you get that sort of the issues aren't being triggered. They can have an actual conversation where you really can't converse when you're being triggered. It doesn't work that way.
If everybody has the traumas, is everybody reacting to the traumas in the same way? Like, does it always manifest in marital discord?
No, it's the people react differently to the different triggers.
And it does usually always result in marital discord, but it's always showing up differently for each person. That's why it's so important to figure out what's going on with each person individually and then how they work together as a couple.
So is the emotional gunk always unresolved childhood issues, or could it be issues that arise perhaps later in life or arise as a result of the relationship, the spousal relationship, for example?
Well, it's all the above, to your point. You know, the majority of them we find are core wounds that are developed when you're a young child. But there are traumas you get during life. We actually find people have birth trauma, even before they're really aware, or even what we, you know, look at as stuff later on in life that they go through. So it's all the above that sticks in their body, so to speak, that triggers an emotional reaction to something that seems to be a very simple thing.
So it isn't actually the trauma then. It's our ability to sort of cope with the trauma or overcome the trauma that really distinguishes success versus a lack of success in relationships, right?
Well, the trick here is this, is that this thing called amygdala hijack. And what that is that your body goes into fear, flight, and fawn within 40 to 140 milliseconds once you're triggered, way before your mind can even get involved. So you can't think your way out of this because you're so triggered, your adrenaline's flowing, your body's tensing up, it's fear or flight. So that's the problem with this and why we have to clear that stuff first before you can actually get to a point where two people have a conversation about what's going on and how to resolve it.
So I gather then a lot of the work that you're doing is sort of helping people with mindfulness and understanding sort of being in the moment.
That's one of the techniques. Absolutely.
Okay. So in that context, perhaps you can explain what emotional safety is and why you think that's so important in the relationship.
If you are dysregulated, you aren't going to be able to function. And so emotional safety is learning how to really go into, when you are triggered, to go into a place where you're not attacking, you're not defending, and you are finding that place where you feel good. You can't feel unsafe in a relationship and experience true connection.
So I understand that you're of the view that conflict doesn't necessarily equate to failure. If it isn't failure, what is it?
It's information. It's telling you what still needs to be healed in your relationship.
And I guess we're at the stage of the interview where I need to ask the $64,000 question, and that is, what does a high-vibe relationship look like then?
Well, you know, let's first think about what's a low-vibe relationship. And a low-vibe relationship is sadly what most people are experiencing, constant fights, or where the relationship has gone flat, lost its spark, and people are living more like roommates and just going along to get along. But a high vibe relationship is the opposite of that. It's connected and fun and joyful and active because you've got two people that are committed to becoming the highest version of themselves and just as committed to this third thing, which is the relationship itself. So you've got two people who are dealing with their gunk and then nurturing each other in the way they each need to be nurtured.
It's interesting. Some people think, you know, that the opposite of a positive, healthy, fun relationship would be one that you're fighting all the time. But I don't think that's the case. I actually think it's when you stop caring.
Yeah, we actually see both, actually. You bring up a good point because some people argue, but some people get eerily quiet and disconnected. And basically, because of that, there aren't any arguments. But there's no place for you to also grow. That's the problem with that.
And when I was a divorce attorney, I knew it was over when people came in and said, I don't care anything. I don't feel anything. When they came in saying, oh, I hate him, there was still some energy there. There was still some spark there. But when they came in going, I just don't even care and I'm just done, that's when you knew it was really over.
So if that's the case, if somebody came to you now with the work that you're doing and they were apathetic or they'd run out of energy to care anymore, mm-hmm. can their relationship be fixed?
If they do have some level of caring, if they've got some level of caring and energy, then it definitely can. Because underneath that flat is a life force energy that is wanting to bubble up, that is wanting connection, that is wanting love. And if you can connect in with that, then you get this Vesuvius of love and emotion and joy and connection that is just incredible.
Yeah, probably more like an Etna of emotion as opposed to a Vesuvius, which isn't active anymore, right? Because if it's the Vesuvius, then I think we're out of luck. It sounds like there's no help, right?
A little hot. That's true. Good point.
Excellent. Well, thank you both for coming on the show today.
Sure.
It was so great. Thank you. We'd love to come back.
That was Deborah Stangl and Richard Keppel. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the global gut microbiome on The Tonic.
People just like you, with pain, inflammation, and mobility loss, are traveling to BioFlex Laser Therapy Clinic for treatment. The clinic is helping Canadians and patients from around the world move better, feel stronger, and live without limitations, all thanks to BioFlex Advanced Laser Therapy. If your goal is to reduce inflammation, relieve pain, and support recovery without medication, injections, or downtime, get to know BioFlexClinic.com. Trusted, non-invasive care.
Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
David Nelson is the owner of Inside You, a local health food store in Woodstock, Ontario, and a faculty member with the Nova Institute for Health in Baltimore. He's a writer, researcher, and educator focused on nutrition, the microbiome, planetary health, and human flourishing. His work connects emerging science with practical wellness, and he's a frequent guest on the show. Welcome back, David. How are you?
Good, Jamie. Good. How are you doing?
Doing great. So you and I both read the same article about the gut microbiome and kind of like I would call it the global gut microbiome. And I reached out to you to see if you'd be interested in chatting about it today. So here we are. You ready to go?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about it. It's exciting stuff.
So for those who don't know, let's circle to the basics. What is the gut microbiome and why has it become one of the most exciting areas of health research today?
It's a great question, Jamie. The gut microbiome was actually discovered about 100 years ago by this this Russian called Metchnikoff. And you know, we really didn't understand its importance until about 10 years ago. We realized, wow, this is actually an ecosystem that lives on us and inside of us, basically, and it affects our health. So basically, over the past, say, 20 years, we found microbiome breaks down food. It makes useful compounds. They're called postbiotics. It helps train the immune system. It also helps to keep like pathogens. So that would be things that make us sick in check. So we have like two ways we can fight off infection. One, the microbiome helps us. And two, we have the immune system. What makes basically what makes this so exciting, Jamie, is the idea that this looks like it's absolutely intersectional with health. And when we see the microbiome a little bit differently, we see that maybe the microbiome might not be causing dis-ease or disease, but it is absolutely related, and we have to look after it if we're going to look after our own health. So it's very exciting because it expands our understanding of how we need to be healthy.
So most people think of bacteria as sort of being bad, but the truth of the matter is there is harmful bacteria, and then there's more benign bacteria. No bacteria is necessarily good, but there are those that sort of are symbiotic with our system.
Right.
So what's the difference between those bacteria, those types of bacteria?
Yeah, it's a great question. I kind of look at it this way. You know, when we get sick, it's just the wrong microbe in the wrong place at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. That microbe has a job somewhere in the ecosystem of Earth, but just not inside of us. So that's the thing. It's less about sorting these microbes now into good and bad and more about what's it doing. Where's it located and who are its neighbors? This is actually the big piece now about who this microbiome or who this bacteria's neighbors are. And that actually determines whether or not it makes it good or bad. So when we have a microbiome that's quote unquote peaceful, that just means that it gets along with everybody that's already there. But when we get a quote unquote infection, like things like Klebsiella pneumoniae, you get pneumonia from some of these things, or you get E. coli in your bladder or your urethra or your, frankly, your intestinal tract. That's too much or a bad player with everybody else. So that doesn't work. And then they start producing things that cause us to feel terrible. And that's the thing. It's about ecosystems and communities and less about a very single good or bad bacteria.
So the article that I mentioned off the top was in New York Times Magazine, and it was about two scientists who travel around the world collecting microbiome samples. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know, why is it important to study people from different cultures, diets, and lifestyles instead of relying mostly on the research from North America and Europe?
Well, what happened originally when the microbiome research started, you know, picking up? And this was an interesting part of the article here, is that a lot of this microbiome research came from North America and Western Europe. So we have some good data on North America and Western Europe, but that actually doesn't apply globally. We can't take that slice of what we found from North America and Europe and apply it to everybody else. Here's the reason. Food, the food supply, so what you're actually eating, what your water looks like, how well where you live has a sanitization strategy, how many antibiotics early kids may be given or you may be given, where your geography is, if you live in an urban rural environment. All of those things shape the microbiome that we carry. So we can't really make recommendations about a microbiome if the data is just coming from North America and Western Europe. And I think it's just important that we study communities around the world, because that gives us what's basically a fuller map, if I can put it that way. We have to do it properly, but it does give us insight into how the microbiome actually helps human beings survive based on the massive variety of places that we can live and how different those places are. I'll give you one super quick example. Like when you know you go travel somewhere and you might eat some food, like street food, yep, for example. Sometimes that can make us sick. It's not that those microbes are necessarily bad. It's just that people who live there have become acclimated to them. And if we lived there, we would get acclimated to that too. It's just that those microbes are a little bit out of place in us, but not in that food supply. So that's regional variation of the microbiome, super important to understand.
And you know, perhaps the most interesting point, which kind of extrapolates from the one that you just made in the article, is that there is no such thing as one healthy, yeah, gut microbiome. It looks different where you are in the world. And why do you think that's changing the way scientists are thinking about gut health?
Well, I actually think that these microbes are providing us with a lot of advantages. And when the community, the microbes that work together in community, when that reaches a point of, you know, flourishing or optimization or whatever, you actually get healthier. So there are a lot of studies now showing how this variation works. And it's not necessarily like, you don't have one perfect guest on the guest list, right? In terms of what bacteria is going to tip the balance for you. This is about ecosystem management, the right jobs, the right people, or the right bacteria that help the community to be resilient. But there's no single healthy microbiome because it's dynamic. This is the new information. It's dynamic. It updates every meal. Every time, say you get on a plane and you fly to a different country, your microbiome's already adapting to where you go. So essentially what happens is that because the microbiome is a community, there's no single one player that's going to necessarily tip the balance. The bacteria have to work together. And in working together, that's what gives you a healthy microbiome. So it's not necessarily about the individual single. It's how everyone works together, kind of like the way that we work socially with human beings. It's a very interesting pattern that we should pay attention to.
Let's shift gears and talk about the listener's microbiome. You know, there's no shortage of products out there promising to improve our gut health, from probiotics to testing kits. Which of these are supported by evidence, and which should consumers approach with some caution if they're trying to improve their gut microbiome?
Yeah, well, in Canada, this is a little bit more of a straightforward question because any natural health product on the shelf has to have a natural health product number. And that means that there is some research to back up the claim about what's in there. So the probiotics in Canada, by and large, there are a lot of commensal bacteria and things that we've studied over the years. We're getting more resolution on that now. And I'm a big supporter of probiotics, but just not taken, you know, just willy-nilly. You have to take them for a reason, and you have to take them with food, feed them with fiber and polyphenol. So that's really important. But the microbiome test kits, to be honest with you, there's not really a good standard, and they're still looking at individual bacteria instead of the way that community works together, although that is coming. Expect more resolution, fidelity, and kind of like a directive understanding about people's health in the next 5 years, but we're not really there yet. We're getting there, but we're not there yet. I'm cautionary on this.
If somebody wanted to support a healthier microbiome naturally, what are two or three lifestyle habits that make the biggest difference in your view?
Yeah, great. I'm actually glad you asked this because protein is something that people want to consume a lot of right now. It's really hot.
Yep.
And I want to remind people that too much protein without enough fiber, vegetables, fruits, whole grains, you know, stuff that have what are called non-extractable polyphenols or fiber-bound polyphenols that get digested in the colon, that's an issue. So to support the microbiome, you actually have to eat some things that it needs. So the microbiome needs vitamins, it needs minerals, it needs many, many different types of fibers, it needs all the polyphenols and the colors, the flavors in food, all of those things actually play a role. And then if you're eating a healthy diet, you have to add fermented foods. Around the world, everybody eats fermented foods, except kind of North Americans, because we eat this more ultra-processed food diet.
Yeah.
Although we are absolutely picking up on the fermented food system. And some of my customers, frankly, they'll go on kefir, sauerkraut, special yogurt, and it actually resets their gut. So this is a big, big, big area about how we can support the microbiome.
Time for one last question, and that is looking ahead, how do you think the microbiome research could change medicine over the next decade? And are we approaching a future where treating our gut bacteria becomes part of our routine healthcare?
Yeah, 100%. So I'll switch gears just a little bit and tell you about fecal microbial transplants.
Yep.
So what they're doing is they're taking colonies from healthy people, and they're giving them to people that have a certain, you know, dysfunction or disease. And it started with things like chronic C. diff infections, where you had long-term diarrhea or loose stool due to overuse of antibiotics. They give people a fecal microbial transplant, and that person comes back to normal within 1 to 4 days. So we're starting to look at this for things like why you can't lose weight, why you might have too much blood glucose, fat in the blood. All of these things look like a fecal microbial transplant at some point in the future when we get it right could be part of the strategy. But this is going to be big. You're going to hear a lot about the microbiome every single year for the next decade. It's going to be a hot topic.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show to explain that.
Jamie, it's always a pleasure. It's really good to be on the show. Good to have you doing stuff like this and educating people.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Gordon Chang, Alex Snyder, Deborah Stangle, Richard Keppel, and David Nelson. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic Newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic Newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.